record, yeah, the two buttons, and press the pause.
Page 2, side 1, House Committee on Judiciary, Subcommittee 2, January 24th, 1979, 1:30 p.m., room 350.
Subcommittee on the Judiciary will come to order. The clerk will note those members present, Representatives Strohmeyer and Bugis, are excused. First bill for public hearing today is House Bill 2102. Marilyn Miller.
Mr. Chairperson, I'm Marilyn Miller, the Director of the Governor's Commission for Women. So we have submitted this bill to the legislature. I have written testimony, which I believe is being passed out. The purpose of House Bill 2102 is to allow the court in an annulment, dissolution of marriage, or separation proceeding to change the name of the minor children when requested to do so by the custodial parent. Now, it should be noted that this additional grant of authority to a domestic relations court to include in the decree of annulment, dissolution of marriage, or separation a name change for the minor children is discretionary. It is not mandatory. The bill provides that the court may, not must, change the name of the minor child on the request of the custodial parent. As with all other matters involving children in a divorce case, the court will determine whether the name change is in the best interest of the child and enter its decree accordingly. Despite the traditional concept that a minor child must carry the surname of his or her biological father, the court now has the power, under the name change provisions of ORS 33.410, to change the name of the child when the court, in its discretion, determines the change to be appropriate. This bill would consolidate into an annulment, dissolution, or separation of proceeding the consideration of a name change for a minor child, which must now be heard in a separate proceeding under ORS 33.410. The grant of authority to a domestic relations court to consider a name change for a minor child in an annulment, dissolution of marriage, or separation proceeding would reduce court time and administrative costs. The information we obtained from Marion County regarding name changes for minors would indicate that this consolidation procedure would reduce by 50% the amount of court time necessary to consider name changes for minor children. Consolidation would also reduce attorney's fees and court costs, which the public must now pay because a name change for a minor child can only be done in a procedure separate from an annulment, dissolution of marriage, or separation procedure. For example, under House Bill 2102, the court would be allowed in a domestic relations proceeding to change the name of a minor child whose psychological or sociological development would be impaired because he or she carries the name of a biological father whose name is despised in the community due to infamous criminal activities. The bill does not expand or diminish the present power or authority of the court regarding name changes for minor children. It merely provides a method whereby the name change for minor parents whose parents are minor children whose parents are involved in annulment, dissolution, or marriage or separation proceeding can be heard and determined by the court in that suit rather than in a separate name change procedure.
I've got a couple questions. I do some domestic relations practice when I'm not in the legislature. And one of the, I guess you would say, scenarios that I generally see in my practice is a woman will go through, a man or a woman will go through a dissolution proceeding. More often than not, it's the woman who gains custody of the children. Not always, but more often than not. And then at that point, there are difficulties with visitation that start to occur. Occasionally, some problems with child support collections on the other side. The wife finds a new boyfriend or someone else, which is her right to do, and that person is almost supplanted into the role of being the father in that family unit, making it even more difficult, you know, for the real father, the biological father, to have the education, to have some kind of contact with the children that were the issue of the marriage. And I'm just wondering whether or not we should make it easier for either spouse to have name changes of the children in these types of situations, because I see that one more psychological blow, basically, for the non-custodial parent, you know, to basically be separated from the children.
Well, I practiced law for 5 years, too, and did a lot of domestic relations work, and my reaction is that I think for expeditious handling of these particular issues, it is better to have it in a domestic relations court where the judge considers the issue of name change. I mean, it is totally discretionary with the court, and if let's say, the custodial parent is determined to have a name change for the children, that parent is undoubtedly going to file a name change proceeding. And it seems to me that the issue should be resolved on the side of expeditious handling of it, not throwing up barriers and roadblocks to people finally getting a determination of the issue involved, because so long as the issue goes undetermined, it does nothing but aggravate everybody involved. So I think there's something to be said for finally having a place and a time to determine an issue like that.
You don't feel that by having this in the statute that would encourage people to seek that?
Well, I'm not certain that one way or the other on whether it would or wouldn't, but even if it would, I would think that it would be appropriate at that point to let the court decide the issue, and then they're done with the issue.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Miller, I also have a heavy domestic relations practice. Do you envision this bill would be used in default situations, which of course would be the vast majority of dissolution decrees, where only one party is present before the court?
I suspect it is possible, certainly if that is requested in the petition, and the respondent chooses not to appear, that issue, along with every other issue on custody and support and everything else, providing they have personal jurisdiction over him, is going to be decided.
For Representative Gardner's reasons, I'd be disturbed to see this kind of thing decided, particularly in a default hearing, because I know how many convenient defaults are taken by the choice of the parties and may not fully understand the implications of whether they be sociological or legal. I think that there ought to be a requirement, or we ought to consider some kind of requirement, that both parties have to be present or an appearance has to be made when a change of name for the minor child is being requested. And that's just off the top of my head, but it bothers me that something of this importance could happen without both parties being present. Now, if there were a consent form by the other spouse or something like that involved, I have no trouble with it.
What would you do in a situation, for instance, what I'm concerned about is if they get personal service and the person refuses to come in, and it's really a situation where the child's name should be changed. I mean, I can think of some cases, for instance, when convicted felons with, you know, tremendously bad names have, the children have had to have their names changed, and I'm concerned about people that won't show up in court so the issue can be determined.
I see your point. That's all I had on the question.
Chairman,
I'm probably one of the few attorneys that have ever gone through a contested name change in this exact situation, so maybe my question is trying to be a little pointed. Your statement was to the effect that this did not expand or diminish the power or authority of the court regarding the name change. But however, the standards that are used now in this situation are one where there's been a divorce, a decree has come down, custody has been granted to one spouse, and then the non-custodial parent, due to inattention, not paying support and such, is subjected to this. And it's not correct. I'll give you a case site too if you want it.
Okay, well, what I had thought was, of course, that the name change would be entered into the decree. Now, the example you gave me, I understood, would be a situation where subsequent to the entry of the decree, due to the fact that the husband would not pay support or whatever, that the petitioner would then want to move to change the name.
That's what the way it is now.
Then my feeling would be that name change would go under the name change statute.
That's the process as it is now.
Yeah.
What I think he's saying is that your statement that you're not diminishing or expanding the situations in which a name change can be granted is inaccurate, because presently you can only get a name change where there has been inattention or failure to pay child support, whereas under your bill, You're proposing
that would be
just a matter of course that the court should so decide.
Mm-hmm.
Chairman, more articulate.
Well, I think if both the parties are before the court, yes, I would agree with you in that regard. Then it would change the powers of the court or the situation in which name change would be granted.
You said that it would not increase the time spent by the court, but on the other hand, having been through one of these, I'm a little dubious of that because I found this to be an incredibly bitter process.
Well, I would think it would be
a non-custodial parent. Not only is the non-custodial parent non-custodial and paying child support, and there's also probably a property settlement to go along with it, but then the name is going too. And we've seen, if you practice domestic relations law like some of us, we've seen some very bitter fights over Aunt Emma's crystal goblet. What kind of fights are we going to see over this name change at this stage of the process?
Well,
down the line, 4 years where the non-custodial parents did not pay child support. And incidentally, I lost that particular case.
Our feeling was that you know, it seemed to me that a domestic relations court decides tremendously important issues as far as children are concerned. Custody, for one thing. And I mean, if the court can decide the matter of custody, the court can certainly decide whether the child should have a name change for some reason. And it seemed to us rather onerous and expensive in administrative costs and court time to have to go to a separate proceeding to handle that issue.
You do not agree then with the current case interpretation that there is an interest that the father has in his children bearing his name. I think it was one of the justices in not the Olek case, another case, said that that's comparable to comparable to termination of parental rights. You can put that in the same category. The courts have approached it as almost like termination.
Well, I'm not suggesting that the courts would decide with ease to change the surname of a minor child. I'm just merely saying that this offers the parties a forum in which to air that issue.
Two questions. The first one is, do you feel that the child has some interest here that is perhaps not represented by either the custodial or non-custodial parent in being known by a certain name?
I think that in most cases where there is an issue involving the child, yes, the child probably should have a representative of some kind. Whether the child has an interest in a name that, let's say, should require that an attorney be appointed for the child to represent the child in that particular instance, I frankly have difficulty seeing some kind of vested interest in a particular name that would require the court to appoint counsel for the child.
My second question is, outside of the cases where you have a rather infamous criminal, which I think are probably rather few in number, you probably agree to that, what other circumstances can you see that would require that someone be known by a different name?
Okay, there was some testimony that was submitted, and you may have it, that I think points up some examples of situations where the child would perhaps it would be more consistent to the child's day-to-day living situation to have the name of, let's say, the custodial mother should she change her name in a divorce proceeding. For instance, it is extremely confusing to children to be known by one name when their mother is known by another name. Or, you know, to have the school records show a name, try to locate the mother who has another last name and that sort of thing. I do think that at least points up some instances where children possibly would be much more comfortable with the consistency of having the same last name as the custodial parent.
I've just been handed testimony regarding House Bill 2102, this is your testimony that you're...
No, that's not my testimony. That's testimony submitted by another group of individuals.
Are they going to testify?
No, they're not.
Okay. Under three, it says here, it eliminates an unwanted psychological tie to a former spouse. It permits a fresh start to a newly single parent. Do you think that that's a valid criterion for us to pass this bill out of this committee?
Well, I'm not suggesting that that is a sole criterion. I think that that is one opinion that a group of individuals has about why they support this bill. And I think that, you know, it certainly is a possible consideration. But I'm not saying that this committee should use that as a justification. I think there are a whole lot of other reasons why this is a good bill.
Representative, I know I'm familiar with your point about the inconvenience of two names, the custodial parent having one name, the child having the other name. In the case I was involved in, this was presented to Judge Diaz,
mm-hmm.
and Judge Diaz, I'll relate to you her reply, not my reply. Judge Diaz's reply was that the other side of that sword is that if you bring consistency in the name to the non-custodial parent and the child, you're also going to create a public situation where the child may be perceived as not ever having had a, infused an anachronism now, a legitimate father, in the sense that if you go from the non-custodial parent of Ms. Smith, the child Jones, to Smith,
mm-hmm.
it looks like there never was a marriage there to produce the child. And I realize legitimacy is not a
right.
legal consideration, right. but there, at this point, was brought up by Judge Diaz.
Well, I think that another point that, you know, is one that a lot of people have concern about is, and that I am somewhat disturbed about, and that is the fact that somehow, I think, in this state and elsewhere, children are still viewed as property, and the father has a vested interest in having the child retain his last name. And I'm not certain in my own mind that that is a good justification in and of itself for disallowing a child the opportunity to have some name consistency with the custodial parent, because that really is the day-to-day identification that the child has is with the custodial parent, unfortunately, but that's true.
But the child does not bring the petition, however, to change the name.
Yeah, essentially that's true, right.
Any further questions from Representative Cohen?
I'd be interested on point one, if we're talking about reducing court's backlog. Do you have any indication of how many of these kinds of cases come before the court?
On name change?
Yeah.
I honestly don't know. We tried to find that out in Marion County, but they don't really keep track of their records to log them in by how many name changes they have or anything like that. I personally didn't see that part in there. I honestly would be surprised if there's any tremendous backlog of name change proceedings. I'm sure in most counties there is often a tremendous backlog of domestic relations cases.
Excuse me for being late, because I think, judging from conversation with Representative Smith, you may have covered it, but I'm a little concerned about the fact that there may be a number of uncontested or of default proceedings in which this may be done as a matter of course without any arguments from the other side having been made. And there is no requirement in the provisions as you propose them for any kind of contested hearing or notice to parties or even mandatory representation of either the child or of the absent spouse. And I'm wondering what your reaction is or perhaps was to
okay.
that question when it was raised first.
All right. I think the issue on the default part of it certainly is one that probably could be and perhaps should be addressed. I guess my reaction is that many people allow a whole lot of things to go by default, and I guess I'm having trouble seeing if a man is willing to let the custody of his children go by default, why should he have greater rights to a hearing after proper service and that sort of thing on the name change part of it?
Well, the bill, of course, applies to separation proceeding. I mean, this can be done in the course of the separation,
yeah,
not
really
the dissolution or custody,
right.
So it really is
right.
fairly early in the proceedings, this kind of what I think legitimate regarded as what is thematic.
Right. Okay, and I
place, and, you know, that's what I'm trying to wrestle
right.
with.
And I understand your concern about that. I Again, I guess I'm somewhat at a loss to decide why the father, let's say, should have some supreme rights when it comes to the name change part of it, when he's just willing to let everything go else go by a default. But you know, if that is a matter that, that bothers the committee members, then I think that probably an amendment could be worked in the bill that would not allow the name change in a default situation.
I would point out to both the witness and the committee that it says spouse here, and we could have a situation where the father was a custodial
most
parent
definitely.
And would be, I guess, retaining the name of the child.
There could be a situation such as now where people have given hyphenated names to
that's
children,
right. Yeah.
And
that's right.
He could be asking that, that half the name be dropped.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true.
Okay. I have one question of legal counsel. Is an annulment an appropriate remedy in a case where there are children as issue of the marriage? It's been a long time since I've researched that, but
I think it can be, but I'm not all sure.
By definition, I think if you have an annulment where there's children,
I don't believe
didn't prove one annulment, and that's the issue of consummation. It's still an element in annulment.
Well, what about premarital promises?
That's a minor point. Any further questions from members of the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else to speak on House Bill 2102? Okay. We'll move then to House Bill 2103. That's correct. Jenny McCoy.
Hi. Members of the committee, Chair. I'm Jenny McCoy. I work as the Administrative Assistant with the Governor's Commission for Women. We've introduced House Bill 2103 to clarify domestic relations jurisdiction for the circuit courts of the counties of Marion and Multnomah. This will replace the word wife with the word spouse in provisions which delineate the jurisdiction of the circuit court and the judges thereof in Marion and Multnomah County. This bill does not affect the existing domestic relations statutes. It does conform the language regarding jurisdiction of domestic relations proceedings with the existing statutes. The domestic relations statute refers to spousal support, where this particular jurisdictional statute indicates support of the wife. This change will eliminate confusion which may result from the inconsistency of the language.
Just one question. Has there, and I don't know, maybe one of the other attorneys on the committee or the witness can answer, have we had any situations in the state yet where a woman has been ordered to pay support?
Yeah.
We have.
Yeah.
Okay. That's my only question. Questions from members of the committee? Representative Omar.
Yeah, technical question with respect to the savings clause in Section 3. Maybe this could go to committee counsel. Is that appropriate language for a savings clause?
No, it's not.
So, yeah, you can't go to Section 3.
I'd ask the question if, in fact, if we're only cleaning up the language in the statute, whether or not that provision would be necessary. There's no substantive rights that have been changed by the bill as proposed.
I guess the clause is so sweeping, I'm not sure what a right acquired or accrued would be. I guess I don't know what we're talking about, so I want to know what we're saving or not saving. And I guess I'd go along with you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I'm not sure the clause is necessary, unless I'm a little clearer what it is. What might be?
I don't think that we added that clause. I think that was a present from legislative council. Yeah.
Did you make a note to check into that? There may be something here that we haven't thought of that may decide what our determination of the bill would be. Mm-hmm. Any further questions of the witness by members of the committee?
Mr. Chair,
the
witness. Is there any other legislation pending or proposed that's going to deal with these same sections? So it just might be pumped into them. Could someone do an OLA search on this before we act on it? We're changing two words, in the course of a huge bill, and maybe if it's possible to conform this into other amendments that might be pending, it might we might want to hold off at least that long to make sure we duplicate.
So you want to hold off until all the bills are...
Not necessarily. I don't see any problem supporting this, speaking personally, but just to consolidate actions, we might want to wait a little bit to see if the computer shows us any other section.
Any further questions or comments? Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2103? Okay. Move on to House Bill 2108.
House Bill 2108 amends specified statutory provisions to make them applicable to widowers as well as widows. The purpose of this bill is to equalize treatment under these enumerated statutes for both widows and widowers. The revision is an effort to make these statutes sex-neutral in their wording and impact. Several of the statutes relate to provisions concerning veterans. According to the Veterans Affairs Office, the term widow is at times interpreted to mean surviving spouse, thereby implying but not assuring that widower may be included. However, the State Revenue Office only allows widows the property tax exemption. Some provisions of the veterans laws are administered through individual counties. There is currently no assurance that the word widow has been interpreted to include widower by each governmental entity. This bill would clarify those persons entitled to benefit by adding the term widower. The number of widowers who could benefit under this bill is not known. However, as of June 30, 1976, there were 5,600 female married veterans. These veterans could leave a like number of surviving spouses who would benefit under this statutory amendment. The statutes which would be amended are included in the research report prepared by Pam Seiler in March 1978 for legislative research entitled Sex Discrimination in Oregon Statutes. This bill also gives female veterans full acknowledgement of their contribution to the service of the country by extending the same benefits to their surviving spouses as are extended to surviving spouses of male veterans. Other portions of the bill address language regarding partnerships and the right to sue a third party for a worker's injury or death. The amendments would eliminate discrimination against the widower.
Just a comment, not a question. I think whatever action this committee takes, the bill should probably be referred to Ways and Means, because for the 5,600 female married veterans, there is a fiscal impact to the bill.
One other comment, Mr. Chairman.
Nathan?
There will be a bill introduced on the exemption per se and the amount of exemption that I have. Representative Davis and I have that bill on the desk now, and it's 7,500 now. That's not a strange bill, I think. It's been around for a okay.
I have a question about this then. How do we get through basically the spirit of what we want to do with this particular section of the bill, which is to expand those rights to specifically include widowers so they aren't discriminatory? If you refer it to Ways and Means, will that come up?
Well, the only reason that I suggested the bill be referred to Ways and Means is because it does have a fiscal impact, and it's been the history of the legislature that when there's a bill that has a fiscal impact, that it is, regardless of whether there's a subsequent committee that it may go to, that it is referred to Ways and Means for their consideration. I'm not trying to kill your bill. In fact, I support your bill. But especially where the impact looks like it might be somewhat substantial.
Technically, this is a revenue impact rather than a fiscal impact on the appropriation side, and I'm wondering if Ways and Means would be appropriate.
There's a revenue analysis, and I think Terry Drake is here, who did the revenue analysis
from
the revenue staff.
Do you want to come up?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, Terry Drake, Legislative Revenue Office. There is a revenue impact, but just to point out, there is no revenue impact on the part of the state general fund. There is a revenue impact typical of all exemptions that are unfunded, that you are creating a shift from one type of property to another. When you're exempting a certain amount of value, realize that I think this bill is for the most part prospective in that it has very little of that type of shift at the outset. I cannot quantify that. I cannot tell you in the near future how many of the widowers would be qualifying for the exemption. One would suspect a very small percentage of them. And I don't mean to argue against a referral to the Revenue Committee, but there is no revenue impact on the State General Fund. But, and you're talking about a relatively, the revenue impact statement's been handed out to you, certainly a very relatively small tax shift to other forms of property at the outset in the near future.
There are however, I did help from their testimony, 5,600 married female veterans. That's it's hard for me to believe, but if they say that that's how many there are, there are at least that many.
Which in the future would
probably increase.
Yeah, which in the future, I realize that you're not talking about giving an exemption to the. I don't think you're not talking about giving an exemption to those. You're not talking about giving an exemption to those individuals until you've got a widow or widower situation. And that's the prospective comment. I mean, eventually you are talking about, the number's probably larger than that as more and more women enter the armed services.
Questions from either of the witnesses by the committee?
The 5,600 female married veterans, under Section 3 of the bill, doesn't apply to any veteran. Honored or discharged veterans of certain wars, war veterans, 40% disability.
Mm-hmm.
Did your 5,600 include all veterans or ones who fall into these categories?
It was all of them. I wasn't able to get a breakdown of particularly what systems they were in. My understanding is that it's primarily nurses that are in that category right now.
But the 5,600 then is not...
That's the biggest number I could come up with.
Okay.
And they're all alive.
Yeah, so the 5,600.
Okay, and it's your understanding that... It's not every
veteran. Oh, no. Our best guess at this point, they would probably be talking about less than 100 individuals that would be eligible.
I don't imagine there are many widowers of veterans of the Hispanic American War, Philippine Insurrection, or the Boxer Rebellion.
Who are disabled?
They don't have to be disabled.
The veteran is disabled.
Yeah.
Any other questions for the witness, by members of the committee? Thank you very much. Mr. Elmo Mills.
I'm Elmo Mills, the Director of Veterans Affairs, and some of the county service officers who are in your county have run into a problem. I'm speaking to the section concerning the tax. They have, I think of Roseburg and Josephine County. They apparently have one or two really disabled widowers, and they're interested in this. The number, we do not carry any numbers. We don't know how many they are. But I would agree with the party here that Spanish and American War, we wouldn't have very few. Also, on the other portion of the indigent fund, there's a few cases where they, one or two, where they've had to furnish money. This is county funds that they furnish to get somebody to the hospital or something. And I come and tell you this about that. We work with the county service officers. The Department of Veterans Affairs subsidizes it with state funds. And they, in turn, we get a great deal of service from them by having them in the front line to interviewing people that saves us from having people out there in the front line.
Any questions for the witness? Thank you. Anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 2108?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is George Miller. I'm an employee of the Department of Revenue. And the statement's been made here about the department not recognizing a widower as being qualified for the War Veterans Property Tax Exemption. And that's true. We do not consider the widower to be qualified because the law specifically says widow. I'd like to just to make clear to you as committee members what this exemption does. I got a few hang-ups about it. Maybe I should be here testifying as a taxpayer of the state of Oregon rather than an employee of the Department of Revenue, but the department has expressed in the past its concern with tax programs that concern social benefits, and maybe this is the area that we're getting into here now. To be qualified for the War Veterans Exemption, under the present statute, the war veteran must be 40% disabled. The war veteran himself must be 40% disabled and so certified by the Veterans Administration. If he has a disability that cannot be certified by the Veterans Administration, and he is certified by his doctor and a county health officer as being over 40% disabled and has an income of less than $2,500, then he is also qualified for the exemption. In either of those cases, in any case of a veteran that is qualified veteran under the statutes, and there is specific language relating to who qualifies as a veteran during certain time periods of war and what have you, regardless of whether that veteran is disabled, his widow under the present statute is qualified for a $7,500 property tax exemption. Now, if this bill would pass, you would find individuals that had never served a day in service, never been out defending their country, could have been working at the war effort while the rest of the guys were maybe out fighting the war, happened to marry a young lady that served in the service, she dies, he gets a $7,500 property tax exemption.
Couldn't you have just the opposite situation where you had a woman that, you can turn that just around though, can't you?
Turned around now, it qualifies. And as an individual, I've got no problem supporting the veteran of a widow or contributing to her benefits. But for some guy that maybe stayed home and made a bunch while everybody else was out fighting, I've got some problems with that. I should be paying part of his property taxes.
Okay. Any questions for the witness?
Nobody has stated how much is involved in this. They said numbers. In the state of Oregon, 1977, there was $215,731,000 in assessed value taken off the assessment roll. At a $22 estimated tax rate average statewide, that amounted to $4,746,082. That was being attributed by other taxpayers to the support of war veterans and their widows in the area of property taxation.
Okay. Any further questions for the witness? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2108?
Chairman, from the question of counsel. John, if you have time, I'd like you to understand page 3, line 6, it refers to interest that's not subject to dower, courtesy, etc., which we haven't had in the state of Oregon for a good 10 years. Is there any reason to retain that kind of language in the statute? I mean, it'd be passive. There might be if the partnership assets included out-of-state people in a state that still recognizes those kinds of marital interests. So I'm not. It may well be that we simply haven't updated the statute in a dozen years.
Any further questions or comments regarding House Bill 2108? Okay, we'll move on to House Bill 2109. Marilyn Miller.
Mr. Chairperson, the House Bill 2109 addresses the civil arrest provisions of ORS 29.520. The civil arrest statute currently applies to males but not females. The purpose of HB 2109 is to amend the civil arrest statute to make it equally applicable to females as well as males. Legislative research in 1978 issued a report entitled Sex Discrimination in Oregon Statutes and identified the civil arrest statute, among many others, as being clearly discriminatory on the basis of sex. To apply the provisions of the civil arrest statute to males and not to females is constitutionally impermissible under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment unless such classification is reasonably related to the purposes of the civil arrest statute. Classifications on the basis of sex are inherently suspect and subject to strict judicial scrutiny. Inasmuch as women are not exempted from criminal penalties in this state which subject them to possible arrest and incarceration in prison, there's no rational basis on which to exempt women from the arrest provisions of the civil arrest statute.
Questions for witness? I have none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 2109? Okay. If not, then that completes our agenda for the public hearing. I'll declare the public hearing closed. We'll now move to work session with the committee's desire on this bill. First bill up on the work session is House Bill 2102. Joan?
In answer to your previous question about annulment, the answer is yes, the marriage can be annulled if it's famous or first cousins. Regardless of children or if either party is incapable of consent because of lack of legal aid, or if consent was obtained by force of fraud.
Okay, thank you. Is there any motion on House Bill 2102 as far as committee action is concerned? Okay, I have a motion. Before I place it, I would just like to make a comment. I think that this bill is unnecessary. I think that it has the potential for a great amount of mischief, and I think that some of the arguments that are given in support of the bill in some cases don't even relate really to the bill and what the bill does. I think there's an adequate provision in the law for a name change of a child if in fact there's an infamous parent that could cause the child harm, or if either of the parties decided that they would like to try to have that name changed. I can also see a tremendous amount of litigation going on. Perhaps instead of cutting down on the burden of courts, this might increase it, because I can see situations where non-custodial parents would perhaps not let a divorce go by default because of the relief asked for in having the name changed. For those reasons, the chair would move that House Bill 2102 be tabled. The clerk will call the roll. The motion is non-debatable.
Representative Judith?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Perlmeyer?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Harrigan?
Aye. Bill's tabled. Move on to House Bill 20. Representative Perlmeyer?
Yeah, since it was... the motion was tabled, wasn't debatable. I expressed some of the concerns I had with respect to whether this can be contested and so forth, and I assume that the motion to table does not preclude later further action to take it off the table and look at ways to modify it if that's the pleasure of the subject.
Any bill that is tabled is always before the committee, and a motion to take the bill from the table is in order. I believe as long as you're on the prevailing side and think it was a unanimous vote, any member of the committee could move to take the bill from the table.
Thank you.
Move to House Bill 2103. Is there any motion from committee? Okay, before I place that, I have some concern about, I think we can move it to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. I would ask that council check with legislative council as to the need or lack thereof of Section 3 of the bill. And when the bill comes up before the full committee, if the motion is successful, that at that point in time we will deal with that. The Representative Mason has moved that House Bill 2103 be sent to the full committee with a due pass recommendation to discussion.
Chairman.
Representative Fromart.
Just the two concerns I expressed and one of them simply economy. If there's some way to pump this into another bill dealing with those sections, it seems to me that's useful, but maybe we don't want to hold it up for a considerable period of time. And the second deals with not only with the necessity of the savings clause, but whether or not it's properly expressed. It simply reads Section 3. It doesn't say Section 2 is added. Section 2 doesn't add Section 3. I wanted to just double-check the legislative council about form style.
I would say that Chair has the same reservation that you have, at least as far as Section 3 is concerned. And those questions will have to be answered in a positive way as far as the Chair is concerned before I do prepare to support the bill. Further discussion on the motion. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bieber?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye.
Stonemeyer?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Jarden? Aye. Motion passes. House Bill 2108 is the next measure.
The motion on House Bill 2108.
So move what?
To the committee. The full committee.
Okay.
You pass the recommendation.
Okay. Representative Cohen has moved that House Bill 2108 be sent to the full committee with a due pass recommendation for discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, in view of Representative Mason's statement earlier that he has a bill relating to the veterans exemption and the reservations expressed by the witness, Mr. Miller, I wonder if I could ask Representative Mason what the nature of the other bill is that he's referring to.
The nature of the other bill would be to raise the $7,500 exemption per se. And then maybe looking over this again, I think that two are on the same subject, but I don't think the two would conflict in the actual language of this bill. The actual language of this bill merely inserts the terms widower and widow, where the other bill merely raises the amount of the exemption. So the two are consistent. If you're looking at the bills together, they have the same language out here, but the highlighted amendments or additions are different on different topics.
Chairman? Representative Smith. Representative Mason, are you stating that your bill would raise from $7,500 to some greater amount the exemption?
That's correct.
Can you disclose the amount?
$20,000. The amount is, however, subject to amendments and to testimony. That was relatively arbitrary.
Is there further discussion of the motion by Representative Cohen? Just one moment. If there's no further representative view,
Did Miller of Revenue say, what was this? I lost me a little bit on the $4 million figure.
I think
he wasn't inferring that this would cost $4 million.
No, I think he was making two points. One, that there was at least potential for substantial fiscal impact from the bill. And secondly, that he had grave policy concerns with allowing men to receive these kinds of benefits when women whom they were married to had been in the armed services. I share his former concern, but not his latter.
Well, I tend to agree, but I wonder, do we have that many? I don't think he said really. He extrapolated some figures, and I don't think really there's a $4 million possible impact.
The figures that he gave to the committee were the figures, I believe, for widows and what they receive under present either disabled veterans or widows of veterans. This is the kind of bill, and it would be my intention when it gets to the full committee to perhaps move it to revenue, because I think that it may not have much impact right now, but it could have substantial impact down the road, because I believe more and more women are in the armed forces. And although I support the concept, I think it's something that the revenue committee should take a look at. Those are just the chair's personal comments.
Are you saying that you would, in full committee, move at least to to have a study about this potential impact?
Well, I just, you know, I think it's probably good policy, but I think that the Revenue Committee should take a look at it. That's my own personal feeling. It may not be shared by any other members of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, you were proposing to do that in the 10-day look, take a peek rule?
We could do it that way. Representative Mason.
I'd like to note for the record that part of the purpose of this, of the widower's or the widow or widower's exemption is that upon the death of the person who had the exemption originally, that there isn't a sudden burden placed on the surviving spouse. And that's part of the intent of this whole provision. And I think we're ignoring that is that when if it's the male that suddenly is deceased, the purpose of this bill isn't that suddenly the surviving female widow's property tax loses the exemption, the property tax goes up, and it cuts both ways. It's not giving them any exemption they didn't have. They've had the exemption throughout the marriage, and upon the death of the widow of either spouse, this bill would merely enable that exemption to continue.
Representative Cohen.
Yes, I have it. I would guess I'd question then why we go to all this trouble to have them do an analysis of it when we're looking at sending it back to the Revenue Committee, and they're going to ask the same people for the same analysis. Or am I naive to think they're going to get some different information? They're going to ask them to run it through again. And the question I guess that I have here was his best guess was there'd be less than 100 individuals involved, and that's why my concern is that we ought to move now.
It's going to the full committee.
Good.
And I may be the only one at the full committee that wants to have the Revenue Committee take a look at it. If that's the case, the Revenue Committee will not take a look at it. But the motion made by Representative Cohen is that the bill be sent to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bearden?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Stormeyer?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Turner?
Aye. Passes. Next bill up for hearing for work session is House Bill 2109. Is there a motion on House Bill 2109?
Mr. Chairman. The question really is construction. It may seem rather minor, but I wondered if we changed the meaning in line 23 by eliminating the word his. Because then the creditors don't appear personal to the person subject to arrest, but rather conceivably could be construed to be anyone's creditor. Is that construction possible or reasonable, or do you think that the language is adequate as it is?
If you just want a seat of the pants opinion on it, I think that the creditors would refer back to the first phrase, or the beginning of the phrase on line 22, when the defendant has removed or disposed of the defendant's property or is about to do so with the intent to defraud creditors, the creditors would refer back to defendant's creditors, which could be either male or female.
I'm sure the preferred construction, I'm really, I guess, trying to make a little bit of legislative history for you.
Okay.
Create a problem for someone. And I would hope that if anyone disagrees with that reading of the statute, they would express that opinion.
If anyone does, I'd speak now forever holds your peace. No one does.
Thank
is there a motion on House Bill 2109?
Move to the full committee with recommendation that it be passed and sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Frohmeyer moves that House Bill 2109 be sent to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Frohmeyer?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye. Passes. That completes our agenda for today. Is there any further business to come before the committee? Yeah. If not, stand adjourned.
Kind of timeline.